This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
C says the scale of the crisis is staggering and survivors' living conditions are appalling.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from IFRC headquarters in Geneva. Details next. Also, protesters in the capital of Comoros want Sunday's elections declared null and void and are calling for the president to leave office. And the head of Ethiopian Airlines today pledged full and transparent cooperation to discover what went wrong with the B737 MAX airplane that crashed. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is appealing for $30.5 million to provide life-saving aid for 200,000 of the most vulnerable survivors of Cyclone Idai in Mozambique. Lisa Schlein reports from IFRC headquarters in Geneva.
IFRC Secretary General El-Hadi Assi is launching this emergency appeal after returning from a visit to Beira in Mozambique. Cyclone Idai destroyed an estimated 90% of the coastal city, according to the Red Cross. Assi says the scale of the crisis is staggering and survivors' living conditions are appalling. He says one shelter facility he saw is a disaster in the making.
One of them I visited was in a school. 3,000 people in a school of 15 classrooms, and the school itself is half flooded, and there are only six toilets, you know, for all those people. So it's not an exaggeration when I say that we're really sitting here on a water sanitation hygiene ticking bomb.
C warns of a high risk of waterborne diseases such as typhus and cholera. He says these and other diseases pose a serious threat in catastrophic situations such as this, but notes they are preventable if speedy action is taken. He says the Red Cross appeal will focus on providing emergency shelter, health care, water, sanitation, and hygiene to those displaced by the cyclone. C says aid workers will make a special effort to help the most vulnerable, the elderly, female-headed households, children, and the disabled, people who most often are left behind. He says the IFRC also will include protection and psychosocial support among its life-saving interventions. In crisis situations, he says, women and children are particularly susceptible to abuse, including sexual exploitation and trafficking. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Even as southeastern Zimbabwe and neighboring Malawi and Mozambique remain submerged following Cyclone Idai, Zimbabwe's capital is experiencing a water shortage crisis. Reporter Kudzai Zenawashi in Harare speaks to stakeholders about the roots of the crisis as well as possible solutions.
Harare has always had a problem of inadequate potable water, but in recent weeks, the shortage has worsened, forcing the Harare City Council to ration the water supply. Michael Chideme is the City Council spokesperson.
The reasons are twofold or multifold, right? We have decommissioned Prince Edward water treatment plant because there is no more water to treat on Seke and Harare dams. Harare is at 7%, Seke is at 6.3% capacity, so we can't treat water there anymore.
Chideme says they are facing challenges with the water treatment chemicals, which is making it difficult to supply residents the little water that remains.
We do not have adequate water treatment chemicals because our local supplier is facing challenges. The local manufacturer has his own challenges in terms of electricity and capacity to deliver. We get our water treatment chemicals to Beira Port in Mozambique. And you all know of the disaster that befell Mozambique and part of Manicaland, through which our consignments come through.
Lorraine Mupasiri is the acting director for Combined Harare Residents Association and says it is unfair to pin the water shortages on the recent cyclone and drought.
But the cyclone that happened in Manicaland, it only happened, this is not a long time. But the crisis has been there for years now. And it has been worsening as the time goes by. It is a whole bunch of factors that are contributing to the water crisis in Harare. Some of the water revenue is not really accounted for.
She adds that the City Council of Harare took a $104 million loan from China so it can upgrade water infrastructure. She says $72 million has been accounted for, but it is not clear where the rest has gone. She says at the time it got the loan, the city was providing 500 megaliters of water a day, and now it provides 200 megaliters a day. Hardlife Mudzingwa is with the Community Water Alliance and says the water crisis is nationwide and that most communities have had to ration water.
The issue of climate change is an international issue. The expectation is that the local authority should come up with resilience and mitigation strategies. It's a national crisis. So water service delivery, the challenges, they are not confined to Harare as a city.
He says that even in the face of a drought, had the country preserved majority of its wetlands, residents would have a better supply of water. Mudzingwa says the poor water infrastructure also contributes to the loss of treated water before it reaches residents. Mudzingwa and Mupasiri say that since access to water is a human right, the government should make resolving the water crisis, preserving wetlands, and maintaining the water infrastructure a priority. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
Police in Comoros fired tear gas and used live ammunition to block protesters marching towards the center of the capital, Moroni. The protesters are calling for President Azali Assoumani to leave office. They also want Sunday's election to be declared null and void because of what they say were numerous irregularities. Among their complaints, that ballot boxes arrived at some polling stations already stuffed, and that opposition representatives have been blocked from observing the vote counting. VOA Swahili service has gotten reports that several people have been shot. At least two of them were opposition presidential candidates. It is not clear if there have been any deaths. Incumbent Azali Assoumani is expected to win the election, in which he faced 12 challengers. His government has denied that security forces used live ammunition against protesters. Comoros, a group of islands in the Indian Ocean, is considered one of the most coup-prone nations in the world. Abortion is legal in South Africa up to 20 weeks after pregnancy, and it is provided for free at government-run clinics. Getting a safe abortion, however, is a challenge. Many women face harsh stigma for seeking terminations and, in some cases, resistance from health workers who oppose abortion. As a result, more than half of all South African abortions end up being performed by unlicensed backstreet providers. In the mining town of Rustenburg and surrounding areas, the problem has gotten so dire that the aid group Doctors Without Borders has set up a special clinic to address the issue. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the area.
Precious, as she has asked us to call her, is 16 weeks pregnant. And so is her best friend, by Precious's boyfriend. That event turned her life upside down and brought her to the difficult decision to seek an abortion. But when she tried to get an abortion in her home city of Johannesburg, she ran into problems.
I simply said, I want to do abortion. And then they said no. And there was two nurses there. And the other one said, like, oh, thanks God, I'm not trained for this. Whilst the other one said, no, like, you have to go back to your to your place and then do it there. And then we had an disagreement there. It's like I'm being against God and stuff, more stuff like that.
Hers is a common experience, and it's what reproductive health advocates say drives 10,000 South African women to seek illegal and sometimes deadly backstreet abortions every year. Rather than risk death, Precious chose to travel to Rustenburg, where aid agency Doctors Without Borders has set up a free abortion clinic because of this very problem. Kaladi Mkhakhlele, who heads the Doctors Without Borders project in Rustenburg, says demand for the clinic's services is high. He estimates he performs as many as 100 first trimester abortions each month, and says he sees women from as far away as Botswana, where abortion is illegal. He actually began his career delivering babies, but switched course, and says he's proud of his decision.
I look back, why did I get myself into this profession? I said I want to be a healthcare provider because I want to help people. And then you see a gap, and like, this is part of healthcare service, and if no one is doing it, somebody has to do it, and I enjoy working with people.
Rustenburg nurse Krista Tsomele has been performing abortions for a decade and says she is proud of her work. She says she thinks some of her colleagues are contributing to the stigma of abortion, and worse.
If you can't help a patient as a nurse, just refer the client to the relevant place so that the patient must get help. Don't just tell her, no, I can't do that, or I can't help you, and leave the patient stranded. That is why they end up going to the bogus. Because when you leave her stranded, now she decides to go outside the street, that is where she is going to die.
It's that, she says, that keeps her going. Through the judgment, through the tears, through the difficult stories she hears day in and day out. Because, she says, whether people agree with her work or not, she's saving women's lives and following the law. Anita Powell, VOA News, Rustenburg, South Africa.
Seventeen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The head of Ethiopian Airlines today said many questions on the B737 MAX airplane remain, and he pledged full and transparent cooperation to discover what went wrong. Still, Tewolde Gebremariam said his airline believes in Boeing, that maker of the 737 MAX 8 plane that crashed on March 10th, killing all aboard. In October, an Indonesian Lion Air MAX 8 also crashed, killing all passengers. The Ethiopian Airlines flight data recorders revealed there were clear similarities between the two doomed flights. Gebremariam asserted that his crews were well trained on this aircraft. All 737 MAX jets were grounded after the Ethiopian Airlines crash. Yesterday, Boeing said it has invited 200 senior pilots, aviation technical experts, and international aviation regulators to a briefing Wednesday on its efforts to ensure the safety of the aircraft. Airlines around the world are scrambling to reschedule flights and passengers as they cope with the grounding of hundreds of 737 planes. Business leaders at the Africa CEO Summit are urging governments to take measures to boost agribusiness on the continent to reduce poverty among farmers. Over 1,500 delegates from across Africa and beyond are in Kigali for the summit, considered the continent's largest international meeting of Africa's private sector. Eugene Wimana has more from Kigali.
The World Bank estimates that in many African countries, more than 8% of the people live on subsistence agriculture. Improving the lives of African farmers is one of the priorities for chief executive officers, international investors, experts and policymakers from the continent and beyond at Africa CEO Forum. Marte Trunket is the managing partner of Infomineo, a multinational company that does business research. He says African governments need more reforms to make agriculture a real business.
One is the land structure. It's the plots are way too small on average, so it's very difficult to increase the productivity of the land. And if you had bigger plots, you could use machines way more, etc., and your yields would improve. Second thing is like the land ownership is a big problem because most of the land property is traditional and it's not on paper, it's not in registries, and it makes very difficult to lend to use that land as a guarantee to buy equipment, to buy fertilizers, etc., and then to increase the yields. And it's very difficult to also restructure the land into those bigger plots that I was mentioning earlier because you don't have a proof of ownership besides the fact that you use it. So it's
Tiana Rasaminana, chief of staff of Group Cipromad from Burkina Faso, says without help, women of farmers in particular are vulnerable.
Si vous n'arrivez pas à accompagner ce...
Rasaminana says women in rural areas do not get help. Then we worsen poverty, the problem of rural exodus and other social problems. She says women and young people who can't find jobs in rural areas will be forced to migrate in big cities. And that brings high unemployment rate and crime. African leaders gathered at the CEO summit today have pledged to work toward eradicating poverty among farmers. Zulehatu Kasai Traore is Togo's Minister of Infrastructure and Transportation. She says her country has chosen to first build roads to help Togolese farmers reach markets. Traore says, that in Africa, people take their harvest to the markets. Unlike in Europe, where it might be shipped on planes and boats. She says that is why it is imperative to invest in infrastructure, because government have to give them the way of transporting their harvest. In his speech opening Rwandan President Paul Kagame, said the laws and policies only work if they are responsible politicians.
Whatever we try to do, even in terms of economic development, the result comes back to the politics surrounding it. If it's bad, everything else is bad, meaning politics. That is why open, responsive, and accountable governance is so critical.
The World Bank estimates that in less than a generation, Africa will have the world's biggest workforce, 1.1 billion work-age Africans. Leaders and economic experts at the Africa CEO Forum say there's no time to waste to make sure this population becomes Africa's greatest asset, rather than a burden for the continent and the world. A number of heads of state, including Ethiopia's Sahle Work Zewde, Togo's Faure Gnassingbe, and Democratic Republic of Congo's Felix Tshisekedi are among over 1,500 delegates attending the Africa CEO Forum. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The Democratic Republic of Congo today reported 7 new cases of Ebola have been identified in the past 2 days. That brings the total number of confirmed and probable cases in the country in the country's east, to 1,016. At least 629 people have died in the second largest recorded outbreak of the disease. The International Rescue Committee yesterday said their 58 new cases of Ebola in the DRC last week was the highest weekly number this year. The IRC said it and other agencies have to work even harder to overcome mistrust and misunderstanding in many communities. The outbreak is the first one in eastern DRC, and many communities are distrustful of the health workers coming to care for patients. What's more, there are several militant groups fighting each other, and government forces in the area are making it difficult for aid workers to move around. The Sudanese diaspora gathered on the steps of the Lincoln Monument in Washington, D.C. over the weekend to add their voice to ongoing protests in their home country. Some protesters carried Sudan's red, white, and black striped flag with a green triangle. Others carried the country's former official flag, used well before Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir came to power. Ayan Deng Bior describes why Sudan's former flag is popping up again at protests.
From 1956 to 1970, Sudan's blue, yellow, and green striped flag flew throughout the country to symbolize a new and independent Sudan. That flag is making a resurgence in the latest round of protests around the country and outside its borders. 28-year-old British Sudanese diaspora member and protester Ala Mendor explains why.
And that symbolized the independence of Sudan from colonial rule, Anglo-Egyptian colonial rule, and it will once again serve as the symbol for independence from this current regime. For most of us, that's what it symbolizes. For most of us that grew up in the dictatorship, that were born and raised with Bashir in power, we didn't know Sudan before this Sudan. But that Sudan, for a lot of our parents, symbolizes a better Sudan, a Sudan of hope and potential, a Sudan that was really the middle ground of Africa, that united the Arab world and the African world. Unfortunately, when this regime came, that was shattered, but now we're seeing that happen again. And for a lot of us and a lot of the youth, that's the Sudan that we want to see.
Demonstrations in Sudan continue more than 3 months after protesters took to the streets over high bread and fuel costs. Last week, hundreds of protesters in Khartoum challenged Bashir's three-decade rule during protests led by students. Reuters news agency reports police used tear gas to disperse the demonstrators. Multiple reports say Sudan sentenced six protesters to jail today and fined each of them 1,500 Sudanese pounds for taking part in yesterday's demonstrations. Protesters have been defiant since Bashir declared a national emergency in late February. Sudanese-American Mohamed Maktak says he has been inspired by his people in Sudan.
And we are learning this one not here only from Washington, D.C. here. We are learning actually from the people inside the country. Inside the country, the people that are protesting, they are all young, between 20 and 35. And that's significantly, they're the, you know, the youngest people, they're born in their era. So that's telling us a lot.
Many of those young people have only known Sudan to be ruled by one president. And some, including Sudanese diaspora member Wafa May Ilamin, blame Bashir for the country's weak economy. May says as she looks to the future, she can't help but think of the past era during Sudan's independence when there was vigor and enthusiasm for a new country, emotions that are represented by the old flag.
In Sudan, we see so much tribalism, and so many things divide us, like politics, religion. But the flag kind of embodies the culture of Sudanese people, which I think is being hospitable, being loving, being welcoming, and really standing to those values as Sudanese people. And seeing that flag is just a message that says, despite everything else, we are all one. This Sudan flag represents that, and Sudan is just Sudanese people. Currently, during this revolution, we're all the same.
Sudanese-American Abdel Moinem says the old flag also symbolizes a long struggle for an independent country, which he says paid off.
We were great at that history of time. Sudan was the Sudan at that time. We were in the peaceful, we were in the good condition, good economic of our country, good policies, everything was good. But now, everything has been destroyed. We are going to remember that history.
For several months, protesters inside and outside of Sudan have been calling on Bashir to step down. Ayan Deng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hey,
sports fans. Brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
The Voice of America, VOA.